What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. On today's show, I interview Shahid Buttar, a constitutional lawyer and activist who is running against Nancy Pelosi. Make sure you become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And on today's Patreon-only episode, I play Shahid's responses to some Twitter questions that he got. And to hear more of those Twitter questions and Shahid's answers, please go to patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Thanks so much.
So thank you so much for talking to me. We talked to you on Useful Idiots, the podcast that I co-host with Matt Taibbi. And I wanted to have more of a chance to talk to you because your story, your politics are so interesting.
Thanks,
and your
Katie.
Campaign. Yeah. But also your personal story is really interesting. And I also got some questions from Twitter.
Okay.
From people
who
wanted to ask you stuff. So tell us, though, first about how your personal story affected your or influenced your politics.
I mean, I guess for me, I'd really located in a couple different experiences. Immigration is one. My family moved across the world twice. The first time to flee religious discrimination in Pakistan, we're part of a sect of Islam that is reviled as heretical. In Muslim countries, we're sort of like the Unitarian Universalists of Islam. You know, we acknowledge wisdom from lots of different traditions, and that is enough to make us disfavored in some of those countries. And then we fled the UK to come to the United States in the 70s, fleeing racial discrimination. And having moved around the world to be here, the values that I think have long made this country great are ones that I am very keenly aware of. You know, democracy, liberty, they're not abstract concepts to me. They're
right. They're
concepts worth fighting and dying for, and I'm very happy to lay it all on the line to serve my community and my country.
And what is the sect? You called it a sect?
We're called Ahmadis. Ahmadiyyat is the name of the faith tradition, and Ahmadis are people who follow it.
Right.
And the closest analog I often give to Americans is Unitarian Universalists. The same relationship that they have to sort of mainline Christianity mm-hmm. is not dissimilar from the relationship that Ahmadis have to traditional Islam.
And what makes it different? I mean, is it just historical, or is there a different kind of story? Or
it's particularly the acknowledgement of wisdom and prophetic traditions outside the ones that other Muslim traditions will acknowledge. So we believe, for instance, that every people will have their own messenger. It's a theme that is reiterated many times in the Quran. And I would totally acknowledge like Gandhiji or Martin Luther King as full-on prophets. And that is a heretical view in a Muslim tradition that would think of the holy prophet, peace be upon him, as the final in the line. And we think that prophecy continues in the world today. I think it's demonstrated, every time two people fall in love, it's, I think the traditionalists tend to hold a very stingy view of the presence of the unseen in our world, and I have a very different view of it.
Right.
But to sort of connect all that, as an immigrant in the United States, it's very difficult to feel, to see through the eyes of the institutional establishment. I relate to the empire as someone who is new to it, without a family legacy, without the sort of institutionalized power that like the Pelosi's, for instance, have been able to build. And for that reason, you know, I see the experience of people who don't have resources, people who in a lot of cases don't have opportunities. And my job here, as far as I can tell, as a lawyer, as a liberation agent, is to stand in solidarity with other people who are disfavored by institutions and seeking freedoms and opportunities.
And what was your upbringing like? Tell me about your family, your parents, their story.
Yeah, I'm the youngest of four. My mom was a school teacher. She taught English in England, and was particularly, when we moved to the States, she did a lot of work with English language learners and people who were basically learning disability folks and helping them learn to read. That was her particular focus. My dad was trained in Pakistan and England as a lawyer. He did criminal defense work. When we came to the States, because people who are trained in the British legal system can't practice law here without going to law school again, he ended up taking up a real estate career and did fairly well for himself, lost it all more or less overnight. We lost our home to foreclosure just as I was graduating from high school at 16, and I was going to the University of Chicago, where I went the next year. And within a year, I was on the street because we basically, you know, went from, you know, big house in the suburbs to not having any of those resources. It was a really interesting story of kind of the American dream and nightmare. You know, we moved to rural Missouri in 76, small, super small town, Rosebud, 300 people in this town. There's not a single stoplight, you know, pretty much two last names of the whole town. And everybody was super wonderful to us.
Wow.
Really interesting kind of reflection.
What were the last names? Like Smith and?
The Pullmans and the Waymeyers.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah. Very German-American region of Missouri.
Got it.
And I, you know, frankly, if I were to think about someone in my, with my skin tone and my nation of origin going to the same place today, I don't know if they'd have the same experience that we did then. This was 20 years before 9/11.
Okay. Yeah. So that's,
It was a very different impression, I think, of Muslims and South Asians generally. From there, we moved to the suburbs of St. Louis when I was in the sixth grade, maybe fifth grade, and I did junior high and high school there. And then I spent 10 years in Chicago. When I left college the first time, I was frankly down and out for a couple years, formally unhoused, though I had friends who really saved me from the brunt of that experience. I ended up getting a job at a bank, of all things, and I worked for Merrill Lynch, Solomon Smith Barney, and J.P. Morgan before their respective mergers for 2 years each. And that's how I got my undergrad degree, was going to school at night while I was working for banks during the day. And then I wrote a thesis about radical wealth distribution in a market economy that got me some attention. I got an award in undergrad, and then that got me to Stanford for law school. And then, you know, constitutional crisis unfolds.
Right. Thank God for small favors.
Yeah.
Great for your career, yeah.
At least, you know, the idea of being nimble in the face of current events, perhaps.
And so how did your family lose everything overnight?
So my dad had gotten really heavily invested in commercial real estate. That's where he'd made his money. And the tax law shifted in the 80s under Reagan, basically shifting it such that the commercial real estate interest tax deduction was diminished. And so the incentive to hold commercial real estate diminished pretty dramatically overnight. You know, if my father's real estate holdings were part of a diversified asset portfolio, that might not have happened. But he was very exposed to the commercial real estate market. And so he ended up underwater on a bunch of properties that he couldn't liquidate and, you know, more or less wiped him out overnight.
And what about your parents' politics?
That's a good question. You know, I would describe them as Reagan Democrats. Huh. So they were, you know, people who in the early 80s, at least, were doing very well for themselves, related to politics through the lens of their economic interests, to my vast chagrin. And then over time, you know, my mom, unfortunately, she left us a few years ago to cancer.
Sorry.
Appreciate that. And, you know, one of the parting graces, I would say, is that she passed away in the weeks preceding Donald Trump's election in 2016. And if the cancer didn't kill her, his election would have. You know, we had some very colorful conversations in the last 6 months of her life, particularly debating Bernie versus Hillary 2016. She was just really excited to see a woman in office. And I, you know, I get it. That's,
yeah,
you know,
right.
That people have different reasons to attach to different figures.
Sure.
And my mom, at least by that point, was very... very much over the right wing, very much over conservatives, outraged by all of the things that were happening in the country. And I think, like a lot of people in her generation, boomers, unwilling to embrace the paradigm shift that we need to actually answer the crisis that she was responding to. And I think there's a lot of that in this country, people who are willing to appropriately decry the status quo, but maybe not quite willing to embrace the alternative.
Right, the viable alternative to it, yeah.
Yeah.
And your dad?
My father, I would describe as much more iconoclastic. So he's always been a critic of authority, however it emerges. And in his life, the primary authority against which he was rebelling was religious authority in Pakistan and then British authority in England. And I think his attitudes here in the United States, he's very concerned about immigration is an issue that matters very deeply to him. The civil liberties restrictions on Muslims matter very much to him. I think he has less of a concern about corporate rule, but he absolutely has a concern about liberty principles. So, mm-hmm. And you know, my brothers and my sister are all in wildly different places. I have a brother who served in the U.S. Army, and he was a college football player and his fraternity and relates to politics through a very conservative lens.
Wow.
I have a brother who's a much more like a libertarian. My sister is a center-left progressive. So we kind of are all over the map across my nuclear family. Yeah.
And do you remember were you political? Did you identify as political as a young person? What was that like?
Second grade.
Me too.
Particularly for me learning about the westward expansion, Manifest Destiny, and the land grab, the Native American genocide.
Right.
It was jarring for me. I grew up in Missouri, and Missouri was one of the many places, the entire country, frankly, we depopulated and genocidally waged war on peaceful people. But to be standing, as we are anywhere in the United States, on soil occupied by other people, talking about liberty and justice and a land of the free and a home of the brave when, you know, we live in a country that seems to be much more deferential to authority, you know, a timid, unfree people rather than a brave and free one. And then to understand that there might have been a brave and free people here that we replaced in the service of this sort of different approach. The other thing that I'd say that radicalized me was our faith community. We were so Ahmadi Muslims in the United States are very disproportionately well-networked in urban centers. We were some of the first Muslims here doing active proselytization in the early parts of the 20th century. So the communities here in the U.S. tend to be very, for lack of a better word, bifurcated. There's like a heavily immigrant, largely South Asian presence, often very highly upwardly mobile, let's say, well-resourced. And then there's a substantial portion of the community that is much less well-resourced, much more of color, urban centers. You know, the mosque that we went to is in North St. Louis, a not very well-resourced part of St. Louis. And I could see, particularly in the gatherings that we go to afterward at different people's homes, just vast disparities in experiences and situations and neighborhoods. And, you know, on the one hand, we'd be at a mansion at some doctor's house, and, you know, very friendly people. And then we'd be at an equally gracious and kind and hospitable family that lived in a hovel. And as a young person to see, you know, these are all people who I'd stand shoulder to shoulder with when we'd pray at the mosque, and everybody's living so differently, and to understand the people who are so similar and see similarity in each other treated so differently. It was an alarming thing to witness. And just growing, you know, not being able to go to college the first time because of my both combination of student debt and my family's financial crisis, that was a very experientially radicalizing experience. Maybe another thing I'd throw in the mix here, I was recruited by the State Department to serve as a diplomat in the late 90s under the Clinton administration. I was still in college at the time, and I ended up, one of the reasons I went to law school instead was I did not get security clearance as a Muslim, informed by Marx's analysis. You know, that was
killer combo, right?
Indeed, right. And you know, that was another arena in which to see the abdication of the principles that I take so seriously.
So do you practice?
Practice law?
No, sorry.
Islam?
Yeah.
Ish. I mean, I'm as Muslim as I am Buddhist as I am. You know, I practice Aikido as a Japanese martial art, and that's you know, I'm like any good DJ, I remix.
Right. Which and sounds like it's actually consistent with the faith, with the sex
that
like,
I came from. Yeah. Right. No, that's right. I do think that there's an interesting fidelity to the tradition I'm from in being open-minded towards other traditions.
Right.
You know, gone on Vipassana retreats and gotten great wisdom from those experiences.
I feel similarly about my secular Jewish identity, which is funny because it's like the secular Jewish identity that I have, or the Jewish secular Jewish leftist history from which I come, is one where it's like Jewish to not just marry Jews, for instance.
Right.
Like it's very like if I brought home a religious Jew to my parents, they would like sit Shiva.
Yeah.
You know, they'd freak out.
Yeah.
But if I, oh my God, if I brought home a, like, my dad loves Hinduism.
Okay.
He's like, he loves it. Which makes a lot of sense because he's very intellectual and philosophical and really into, he's a psychiatrist, but like not a Freudian. He's like a real psychopharmacologist guy.
Okay.
And he loves creatures, like cute creatures. So like Hanuman and Ganesh, like and all the stories. And,
gotcha.
But yeah, he'd be very excited by that. But yeah, I have a similar, I mean, I went to the summer camp called Kinderland, and it was founded by communists basically in the 20s, and it was secular Jewish, but always had non-Jews, and like Paul Robeson visited and stuff. But it's the cultural director of it, at one point was this guy named Walter Vega, whose parents are from Honduras.
Oh, wow.
But it was very, and he was like, he talked to me about this because I actually made a documentary about it. And he's like, you know, when they asked me to be the cultural director, I was like, you do know I'm not Jewish. And then I realized, like, it's actually very much consistent with the values of this type of Jewishness, which is like universalist. And anyway.
And the scholastic tradition in Judaism is something that I, you know, take a great deal of like inspiration from.
Yeah, that's interesting because a woman in the documentary says, like, we were the weird Jews, the people who thought you're not really Jewish. We didn't go to, synagogue. We didn't have bar and bat mitzvahs. But the tradition we came out of, like, did have those stories, even though we weren't biblical, you know, we weren't religious, but it had the stories. And she goes through, like, you know, these proverbs, and like Isaiah said, like, why are you going to God? You know, why are you bringing your sacrifices to God when you should be giving it to the poor? And she's like, he didn't use those exact words, and he spoke in Aramaic. But basically, and she talks about why it's like a socialist idea. Anyway.
Well, two thoughts on that, if I may. You know, I think there's this really, you're reflecting on the ways in which culture transcends faith and ideology. And I think there's also like this really poignant example. I think we see this in our country today, how faith can be twisted. And, you know, how many people, you know, are preaching this gospel of supposed prosperity as if Jesus was not a socialist.
Right. A brown Middle Eastern
socialist.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, people who misconstrue their own faiths in the service of twisting them in this, you know, to advance some other agenda.
Yeah.
I think is entirely too unfortunate.
Did your sense of your own identity change after 9/11?
That's a good question. In a manner of speaking, maybe. So I'd started law school really focused on antitrust law. I wanted to bust big corporations, and the aftermath of those attacks certainly changed my life trajectory and made me much more alarmed about civil liberties. And so as a constitutional lawyer, I think that was probably the point at which my focus went from antitrust fighting corporations to constitutional save democracy. And, you know, it's 20 years later, and I'm kind of in the context of our campaign to replace Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco doing both, you know, trying to defend democracy and challenging corporate power. At the time, for me, it was a bit of a pivot. And, you know, the last 15, 20 years have been a slow exercise in weaving those strands together.
Have you met Nancy?
I have not. I have met Christine, her daughter, who they want to put in her seat. And she did
the
run
filmmaker.
For me like I have the plague.
Oh, wow. Mazel tov.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. I just gave her my business card. That's all I wanted to do. But I do think they, I don't think the family has a great deal to say to me. I think they recognize, you know, the threat that I pose to their legacy. And, you know, given that I don't think a family dynasty in a country committed to democracy is appropriate, I'm perfectly happy for them to have that fear, I suppose.
Right. And you were a DJ.
I still am.
You are? Okay. You still, you DJ identify and DJ practice.
Yeah. I have a monthly at a club in the Castro in San Francisco.
Oh, great.
I play every third Thursday there.
Oh, great.
It used to be my attempt, my opportunity to not do politics, to go like hide behind the decks and kind of like just be my old self again. Only now when I go there, it seems pretty frequent. Somebody who I've never met before will come up and be like, aren't you the guy who's going to replace Pelosi?
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, that's me. You know, then we...
You should challenge her to a, what's it called? Like a DJ off?
Yeah, there you go. Maybe I rhyme too. So could we,
have a rap battle? Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, that would be really good.
There is an Instagram post that one of our supporters put up this spring at a party I was playing for Beta Breakers. It's an event that happens every year in San Francisco. Really iconically representative of the city. The whole, maybe not the whole city, but a big chunk of it. Basically dresses up in costume, starts from one end of the city, running and drinking to the other end of the city with some people dressed up as salmon running the other way. And so Beta Breakers happens every May, and I was playing a party for that. And one of our supporters who was there posted a video from the party saying Nancy Pelosi does not DJ parties like this.
Nice, yeah. Very, very limited DJ selection when she does weddings. So I have some questions for you from people who were very excited. Got a lot of response. I tweeted out that I was going to be interviewing you. So I'll just read through a bunch and then you can tell me.
Sure.
Yeah. You already responded to this. Speaker? Pramila.
Jayapal. Who would I support as
Barbara
speaker?
Barbara Lee or whomever might emerge in this. Why did Barbara Lee endorse Kamala.
So let's talk about that. So yeah, the question there was, who would I support for speaker after I remove Pelosi? And I do very much want to support a bolder, more progressive voice. Pramila Jayapal is the leader of the Progressive Caucus. She's the sponsor of the Medicare for All bill in the House. I would love to see her in that role. Barbara Lee, was my favorite for that role until she endorsed Harris. And I think if we look at it through a lens, I think Barbara Lee was either auditioning for a cabinet position, should Senator Harris have won the nomination in the White House, which she clearly will not, or alternatively angling for a Senate seat that Senator Harris would have vacated had she gone to the White House. Right. So I think we have to look at Barbara Lee's endorsement of Harris through the lens of her parochial interests, as, you know, and she is the only member of Congress representing a district in the Bay Area where Kamala's from, who shares, you know, at least some demographic identifier. So it all makes sense. It doesn't make it any less disappointing.
Right. Yeah. But there's a rational. Yeah.
Yeah.
How will you use the office of Congress to stop our military imperialism?
Oh, my God.
Great question.
Yeah, it's a great question. Oversight and appropriations. So we've seen the oversight context used to such incredibly effective results by particularly Ilhan Omar, as well as Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib as well. But I particularly think here of Ilhan Omar's interrogation of the Reagan era war criminal,
so great.
Elliot Abrams.
Yeah,
I have
so
never
I know.
Seen anything.
And it was like the day
like
after
that.
She had been like totally raked over the coals about
That's right.
her, you know, alleged anti, in quotes, anti-Semitic stuff. Yeah,
that's right. And when I saw Ilhan Omar make the first pro-America statement that I've ever heard in the House of Representatives vis-a-vis our military-industrial complex, like, she is the only member of the 535 members of Congress who seems to have read Eisenhower and understand his warning to scrutinize these agencies, to scrutinize the Pentagon, to defend liberty and democracy instead of the corporate interests that underlie war for profit. And when she took Elliot Abrams to task for human rights abuses when no one else has.
I know, it's really
in 30
crazy.
Years,
yeah.
It's like, where are the rest of you? That's my attitude seeing her. And it is such an incredibly inspiring example that I'm very eager to emulate.
Yeah.
I want to turn those same screws. I also want to participate in the funding battles to take money out of the Pentagon and put it into housing, put it into healthcare, get it into food stamps, you know, to get the money out of destruction and putting it into supporting people. That's my ultimate aim.
Right. The Latino Bernie bro asks a very good question. Snake Sparklers is his handle. What is his skincare routine and his beard grooming routine? And we should just make it clear that Shahid does have a man bun. I'm curious about the chronology of that too.
Sure.
Well,
I shaved my head for 15 years and started growing it out, particularly when I started going gray, because it's really high contrast on a dark skin tone. Men have worn their hair in top knots for thousands of years. You know, I mean, Jesus had
long
hair.
Oh, wow. Real chronology. I just meant in your life. But keep going.
I mean,
it's
not a new hairstyle, right? And I live in San Francisco, where we have a particularly storied history of men with long hair.
Yeah.
And I just don't like it being in my face. So I put it up, basically.
Got it.
It's not that complicated.
Right.
Skincare, I don't really have a skincare routine. I wash my face at night and in the morning.
Wait, you want to get a sponsor out of this? What do you use?
I use Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps.
Oh, yeah. He's kind of crazy. Have you ever read the things on his bottles?
Yeah. Well, so he is no longer with us. That's the grandfather.
Okay.
I camp at Burning Man with many of the folks who work at the company.
Oh, okay.
We have a non-commodified camp that is not branded related to the company, but I use the products hung out with a lot of the people who make them.
I like the mint scented
product. Lavender's not bad either.
Lavender, the almond is great.
Yeah.
The almond, yeah. But they say, I have to do a reading of their stuff that they say. It's like about like God and like, I don't even know what it is.
If you boil it all down, I'll take my crack at it.
Sure,
it's all one. All things are one.
And
the essential unity of all things, the metaphysical plane, I think is the point of all that text.
It is the
progenitor of that brand trying to make through whatever means he had available, the case that all people are together. That's what he had. He had the print on his bottles.
Yeah,
he's like, I'm going to turn this into propaganda. And the company, frankly, I mean, I'm not here to shill for it, but I will say that the first time, the only time to this point I've had a chance to visit the West Bank was at an olive picking festival that Dr. Bronner's took me to basically observe human rights in crisis. And they source all of the olive oil for their soaps from fair trade organic
co-ops. Did not know that.
Co-ops.
Maybe
in the West
they
Bank.
Will sponsor me. I would, you know,
do you want to go?
Yeah. What did the Buddha say? This is a joke. What did the Buddha say to the hot dog vendor?
What is the sound of a hot dog bun without a bun, without a hot dog?
Make me one with everything.
I should have known that. That was good.
Yeah, it's good, right? this is another unrelated joke.
Okay.
a Jewish guy says to his rabbi, I don't know what to do. My son has become a Christian. I don't know what to do about it. The rabbi goes, funny you should ask. My son did that too. And they're like, let's pray to God about this. Like, okay. And God responds, funny you should ask. Yeah, yeah. That's good, right? I love that. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
On a related note, what are you going to do to end support for the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land and the Moroccan occupation of what is it called in English? I know it's Polisario in Spanish.
I'm not as familiar with the Moroccan
Sahari
context.
Land. Yeah.
Yeah. But at least with respect to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the very first thing that we can do there, again, is oversight and funding, pulling funding from American support for human rights abusing regimes abroad, from Saudi Arabia and Israel to the Philippines, is at the top of my agenda. And the point there is not just to preemptively address the concerns that I'm being anti-Semitic like Ilhan Omar was supposedly, right? I'm defending human rights, not critiquing any faith. And I'm frankly very eager to be ecumenical in my critique. You know, Saudi Arabia has a very different ideology that shows up very equally abusive of human rights, of collective rights. There's a genocide happening right now in Yemen in which our country is inextricably implicated.
Right.
And just as there has long been a cultural genocide being waged in Palestine with U.S. complicity.
Yeah.
And I'm eager to see the United States stand on the side of human rights instead of against them.
Right. Yeah. People often say, why are you picking on Israel? It's like, well, that is the country that the U.S. government constantly brags about having a special relationship with.
Right.
And we fund them. They're the wife and Saudi Arabia is the side piece, like the mistress.
Wow.
Like, we, you know, because like, you know, they're the white, you know, Israel is our government celebrates our closeness with them. And usually they hide the closeness with Saudi Arabia, although they also are engaged.
That's a brilliant analogy. I like that image. To take it one step further, you know, not only do we fund Israeli human rights abuses in the Middle East, but we also launder them and bring them back home.
Right.
Right. I mean, we have
paramilitarized.
We have paramilitarized police in the United States, and they routinely train with IDF trained forces. Right. So we're giving money to Israel to pioneer new crowd control, I'm using air quotes, you know, suppression techniques to then abuse communities here in the US. And the idea that we're giving money to another country to learn new ways that we can then import their human rights abusing practices means it's not just solidarity with Palestine. I'm interested in solidarity with the United States, which means we have to be more critical to
Israel. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Jeffrey Halper, no relation. But have you read his book? He has a book called The Palestinization of the World or something. It's basically about, it's really interesting because he's like, okay, we know why like APEC, okay, there's APEC obviously, but why does like Ireland not vote against Israel when their country is very Palestinian sympathetic or whatever? And his point is that all these governments that support Israel or don't like sanction Israel or don't, you know, whatever the verb would be, it's because of the surveillance technology and the nano this and the nano that, and Israel's so good at that and, you know, creates all this stuff that they use on their own civilization, their own population.
Yeah.
So, which is why it's like the Palestinization of, it's good.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like Israel buttresses its support internationally by pioneering new forms of authoritarianism.
Right. Which the other countries use. Yeah.
And I do find it especially disturbing given the origin of the country. I mean, it was founded in the wake of human rights abuses, right? And then to adopt human rights abuses, it's just so disturbingly ironic.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
And I mean, if, at least you they should have, like, maybe they should have taken over Germany or something. But what did the Palestinians have to do with it? Let's see. I know you have to, this is really great. Anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't talked about?
Maybe just the opportunity for hope in a dark time.
Yeah, because a lot of people are like, what's your ground game? People are saying, a couple of things. Do you favor abolishing the police and CIA along with ICE? What evidence is there that the Democratic Party can be changed from within? Changed, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Freudian slip, from within. Some people say, you know, that not a lot of people have heard about you outside of certain population. So how can you deal with that? Oh, and then define socialism. Oh, wait, I think this is from a, also asking why it isn't exploitation when the rich are asked to bear such burdens as massive government programs through progressive taxation.
Wow. Exploiting the rich by making them pay their share. That's so exploitative. Yeah. Maybe I'll start with defining socialism to me. And I would particularly define this as democratic socialism because there are sharp distinctions between various forms. But I see democratic socialism as a helix that intersects with intersectional feminism and post-colonial liberation. And that's the lens through which I see all policy. Does it liberate people or does it enslave them? Is this a locus of social control or is it one that gives people more control over their futures? And that's it. Policy to me is very simple because that's the lens through which I see it. It's elegant in its simplicity. And it is rooted in an awareness not only of the hypothetical future that we aspire to as democratic socialists, but also the abusive history that many of us, particularly people whose ancestries are rooted in colonial lands, that we are all coming from. And I do think that the between the relative and various abusive past that we all come from and the shared aspirations we have to a peaceful future, one of plenty, not one of scarcity, not one of resource wars, not one of climate chaos, you know, the aspiration of all people to lead peaceful, just lives, I think is one that can bring us all together. I just bridged that for the hope thing and I'll come back to some of the agencies. I think a lot of people recognize that our current system is corrupt, it is untenable, and they wonder how they can shrug off the yoke of it. And it's a question that has, you know, been at the forefront of my mind for 20 years. And frankly, I think the only answer to it is everything. We have to do direct action. We have to do mutual aid. We have to fund nonprofits. We have to organize affinity groups in our community. We have to fight electoral battles. We have to educate our neighbors. We have to do all the things. And I've tried to do all the things. You know, I have been a direct action organizer. I've organized mutual aid projects. I have done impact litigation. I've engaged the policy sphere. You know, I'm running for office largely because having done everything else, you know, and I see my city that I love and adore as much as I do San Francisco. San Francisco's always been, for 150 years, we've been the home of all of America's countercultures, right? The beat poetry generation, the hippies, the punk generation, the Burning Man subcultures, LGBTQ culture, all got incubated in the Bay Area. It's not the cultural capital. It's not the commercial capital. It's not the political capital. It's the countercultural capital. We always have been. And for 30 years...
getting all verklempt.
We've been represented by, a careerist, someone who is very inclined to support the center, a tool of the military-industrial complex, our police-industrial slavery complex, the pharmaceutical complex. And I'm tired, frankly, of seeing my city co-opted. And in the service of a human rights abusing paradigm that we need to shrug off. So all that is to say, having led a nonprofit and having helped make seemingly impossible things like marriage equality for same-sex couples real, I'm very eager to apply that same set of skills and vision to this liberatory project. And I think the effort to get known, for instance, outside our circles, that was one of the questions. There's the ground game. There's an air game. The ground game is about showing up and being visible. And that's how we've built the campaign to this point, by being an act of solidarity with social movements, promoting human rights and labor rights. And also the air game is about putting the ideas out there. You know, we did a 10-point thread about Veterans Day, noting...
Oh, yeah. Today's Veterans Day.
Veterans Day. And one of the things I was noting is that we celebrate veterans while just horribly demeaning their legacy. Veterans fought and died by the hundreds of thousands, millions in the Second World War to establish human rights principles.
The last time we fought a good war.
Right.
World War II, yeah.
And what have we done since then?
Right.
Repeatedly abused the principles that they established.
Right.
The Nuremberg trials, which we fought a world war to have the chance to prosecute. We sent a Supreme Court justice to prosecute them.
Right.
They stood for the prospect that if you torture someone, you are guilty of an international crime,
right,
full stop. It doesn't matter who said you could do it.
Right.
Didn't matter if you thought there was a ticking time bomb. Didn't matter. There's no excuse for torture. We fought a world war to establish that principle. And who did we lose it to? The CIA.
Right, yeah.
That's preposterous.
Right.
We shouldn't accept that.
And also, of course, the slashing of funds for veterans and all that. So, yeah.
All of that. I'm in a military family. My older brother was in the U.S. Army Medical Corps. And another reason I'm outraged, you know, on Veterans Day, particularly in the context of our human rights abuses, is that by embracing torture with impunity, we place U.S. service members at risk.
Right, which is why McCain was like, not a good idea, the whole torture thing.
One of the very few things he showed up for. That he also tried to take money out of politics, to his credit, and I appreciate that.
And he was the one person who fought for John Kiriakou to get his pension, to keep his pension, which he's lost because of...
I have a hard time being very excited about former Senator John McCain, only because he had me arrested for asking a question.
Oh, right.
So,
yeah.
This just goes to show, on Capitol Hill, you have a lot of people who will show up for one or two things and maybe not on the rest. And I'm very eager to show up for our communities.
He also wrote like an op-ed about the last Lincoln vet to die. I couldn't believe it. Hmm. Like the last, you know, Abraham Lincoln Brigade's the ones who fought Franco.
Yeah. McCain wrote that?
Yes.
That's fascinating.
I know.
I guess his old anti-fascist. I could see that.
And you fight, you know, you put your life on the line and, you know, I know, it's crazy.
Huh. Fascinating.
His daughter is ridiculous.
Don't get me started. Oh my God.
Max Blumenthal and I watched footage of her like pretending to
Why does anybody give her a microphone? Like, what is
Max is like, I don't know why she's on The View. I mean, I don't know why The View is on, but I'll send it to you. We did a little video of it. Yeah. It's funny. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. And this won't come out before, but I'll tweet about your event.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say to wrap up? Or
the future is what we make it. You know, it might be a dark time, but and we might be down, but we're not out by a long shot.
And you think you have a chance?
I have more than a chance.
Some people are saying that. You know, it is one of those things. It's like we say, given how, well, look at Chesa. He just won despite the mayor intervening and naming one of the candidates, her favorite candidate, as an interim DA.
Just like 3 weeks before the election. Yeah.
And then also the sub-police union taking out all these ads against
$650,000
him.
The Police Officers Association lit on fire.
It is really hard, isn't it, just intellectually to be like, these are, you know, the powers that be are so entrenched and we can change them.
Yeah. Well, and I've seen it demonstrated. Right. You know, when we put Chesa in office and Dean Preston, who's a Democratic socialist who now represents the area I live in on San Francisco's Board of Supervisors, our campaign was very active on the ground supporting those campaigns over the last several weeks. So not only have we seen left-wing candidates overcome the entrenchment of career incumbents, but we've been a part of that process. You know, in the marriage equality fight, I've helped make impossible things real before. And I hear in the question a lot of people who are trapped by the present, unable to understand how boundless the future can be.
Yeah.
But I understand how boundless the future is. And I am jumping on the scale with every ounce of energy I have to shift.
Right.
It.
Yeah. I'll make sure to end the interview on that because that's a good note to end on. But do you know Shuja Hader? Do you know his writing at all?
Not yet.
He's and his brother is Asad Hader, who wrote this book called
Haider.
What? Yeah, Mistaken Identities, yeah, about, it's interesting. But something that I was talking about with Shuja, because I said to him, I'm like, okay, I'm a white woman who walks down the street, like I'm Jewish, but no one knows that, you know, I don't go to synagogue, so I'm not going to be targeted by, you know, hate crime.
Sure.
I see Trump as both an aberration, but a continuation.
Yeah, he is both those things.
Yeah, right. Lots of liberal, you know, whatever, neo-libs, whatever you want to call them, he's just an aberration. And you're someone who, you know, you're brown and your name is Shuja and, you know, you walk around and you're seen as brown. Do you feel a difference living under Trump than you did under other presidents? And he was like, yeah, there are times where I'm, you know, afraid for myself or for my family, especially when there's a spike in hate crimes. But I've felt like that ever since 9/11. And he said, and this part was so interesting. He was like, and that's why I'm so like infuriated by liberals who, for instance, were all angry about the no-fly list.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and, you know, John Lewis, what? No, there was this no-fly list that like gun rights. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, particularly in the Bush administration. There's like a million people on it.
But But John Lewis and all these liberals were angry. Like how dare the gun lobby or how dare people sell guns to people on the
no-fly list.
Right. And as Shuja pointed out, like some people on the no-fly list were named like, you know, Muhammad, I don't know, what's it, Khan.
Similarity of names that are common.
John Smith of, because they had, you know, had the same name as someone whose relative gave money to Hamas or something. Mm-hmm. And he was so infuriated by that. And there really does seem to be an invisibilization of Muslim. And then there's this whole like amorphous thing where people just see Muslim, like Sikh. I mean, no, you know, the people
lumping
who are
everybody in together,
who are, you know, which it does make a kind of identity. But that's another question, you know, because like Shuja also wrote about how he is, you know, and the Yemeni bodega owner who is Muslim, Shuja's, you know, secular, how they are now part of this, you know, surveilled and anyway,
disparaged class.
Yeah. Disparaged class. Yeah. And anyway, but it was just an example of how, you know, that they're just so, there's so much erasure by people who like to pretend that they care a lot about disenfranchised people and people of color. And there should be an asterisk. It's like people of color. And I'm not like, I don't want to sound like I'm dividing and conquering and like, oh, those gosh darn like Latinos and black people getting all that. Not at all. But it's like, there's a lot of performative wokeness that doesn't even get applied. Like, they don't even pretend to apply it to Muslims
right.
to Palestinians to Arabs, Arab Americans. The whole narrative about Bernie being only liked by white people when
I was
he,
just,
you
that's
know,
where I was yeah, going to go. Exactly yeah, so, that. Yeah. The disparagement of people of color implicit in denying our voices, supporting right. the president who by vast numbers right. we prefer.
Amo Bernie.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Theo Bernie. There's so yeah. many different right, people yeah. who, you know, recognize that, you know, and it's, I think maybe it's ironic to some people that as a Muslim American candidate, I am very much committed to our first Jewish president
yeah.
because it's not about faith. It's about who is pro-people
right.
and who is part of the death cult that's going to march our species off a climate cliff.
Right.
And
yeah.
I'm with the former, not the latter.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's also he's Jewish in like the best way of like, which is nice because so many people see the face of Jewishness as AIPAC.
Right. He's not Netanyahu.
He's not Netanyahu. Yeah.
He's a real Jew.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's
committed
a mensch.
To human rights.
A mensch. Yeah, yeah.
Right. As opposed yeah. to somebody like Netanyahu, who is
right.
a, you know,
a
imperial right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I wrote a piece about this for Jacobin that it's, I'll send it to you, but Shalom Aleichem, it was so ahead of its time that, you know, his If I Were a Rich Man is based on one of his stories.
Okay.
And it's the exact opposite of what that song is about from Fiddle on the Roof. It's like, if I were a rich man, I would help my wife. But wait, how could I just help my wife? I'd have to help my village. But wait, how could I just help my village? I'd have to help my fellow Jews. Wait, but how could I just help my fellow Jews? I'd have to help all mankind. It's really
yes.
like intersectional and universalist. Yeah.
And when you speak about like, you know, the right kind of Jew that Bernie
yeah.
is, I think about Tikkun Olam. The
yeah,
sacred
exactly.
Jewish mission of
right.
healing the cracked vessel of the earth.
Yeah.
Like he takes that seriously.
Yeah.
Everything he's done for
yeah,
50 years
exactly.
is about healing communities.
Exactly. And there's, it's so interesting because you could take the trauma faced by Jews historically and use that to justify ethnic cleansing, or you can take it to justify struggle for
right.
social justice.
Intersectional feminism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, right.
And his identity is very much shaped by that. And that's another thing that happens. It's like, no, his Jewishness is totally erased.
Yeah, he's an old white man.
Yeah,
they
an
say.
Old white man.
Right. It's like, why isn't that anti-Semitic?
Yeah, exactly. I know when someone asks Bernie's like, is it sexist for you to not drop out because you're standing in the way of the first woman? I was like, is it anti-Semitic for Hillary to not drop out?
Right.
You know,
or to call on the first Jewish candidate who has by far and away the most support in the country to drop out.
Right.
And
yeah.
You know, because somebody feels like he's not, you know, deferential enough to their particular industrial interests.
Yeah, and because they're like neoliberal, like super individualistic feminism, which is just about how much someone's story resonates with you and their
yeah.
journey.
Their white feminism, you mean?
Yeah, but that's... you know, it is white feminism, but I feel like white feminism can be, it's like...
less performative?
Well, no, I was going to say white feminism is like, it is white feminism historically, but it's become, you know, as the world gets more inclusive,
yeah.
you know, like... It's an awkward thing to talk about, but it's like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like hiding behind identity politics,
yes.
you know?
Hugely so. I mean, every time, the entire Congressional Black Caucus is an
oh
example
my gosh.
Of this, right? You have-
Yeah. They went after the Justice Dems for like targeting people of color. It's like, they're
yep.
trying to get people of color candidates in.
Right. Well, and the CBC's role is so twisted to me because these are people who, in many cases, were civil rights leaders.
Right. Like, yeah.
John
like,
Lewis
yeah,
is a good
John
example.
Lewis, yeah.
Who then decided to put their careers in front. And, you know, the fact that they were supporting Hillary.
And said that they didn't see, they saw the Clintons and the civil rights movement, but he didn't see Bernie. It's like, you didn't meet Clinton until 90-something. That's in a book.
Right.
And what is this, like a check-in? The civil rights movement was big. You don't take attendance.
Right.
And Bernie was involved
yes.
then.
He was as involved as they were.
More.
He
got arrested.
Right.
He chained himself. He and black women chained themselves to each other at a protest. Like, yeah.
Yeah, he was certainly more involved than the white moderates and as involved, I think, as the people who were on the front line. Like,
I meant,
he was there
I was saying
line.
More than the Clintons.
Yes,
yeah,
by
yeah,
all means.
Yeah, yeah, that's,
right.
yeah. And he, you know, he organized a sting operation where CORE would go into apartments owned by University of Chicago, and they would say it was like a black couple
testing
or a black person. Yeah, would say like,
yeah.
"Do you have a room? Sorry, no." And like 15 minutes later, a white person, "Do you have a room? Oh yeah."
That's solidarity.
I know.
When you critique people who've shown solidarity because they supposedly aren't showing presence, it just reflects, I think, the co-optation
yeah.
of those voices
yeah.
that are critiquing.
Yeah.
Them.
And of course, he's done amazing things and he almost died in the civil rights movement. But, you know, you have to also look at people as having agency and making decisions, right? You don't want to like infantilize someone
right.
because they almost died. You recognize how important that is. And then you're like, well, they also decided to, you know, like many politicians. But anyway, thank you so much. This was great.
It's super fun
yeah,
to
yeah, yeah,
share some time with you. Thanks
yeah,
so much for having
thanks.
Me on.
Yeah. Awesome. And go to Shahid. For change.
Dot us.
Us. Not me, us. And yeah, same thing on Twitter. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank
that
you for
great.
Having me on. Yeah, super
yeah.
fun.
And to learn more about Shahid and his campaign, please go to shahidforchange.us.
Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. Don't forget to go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. The Katie Halper Show is edited by Ted Reedy. Our theme song is by the band Cordova.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.